Okay. So I apologize for not announcing this in advance. After class on Friday, on Wednesday, Swarup reminded me correctly that I had, that normally the section on memory, the discussion of virtual memory, doesn't happen until later in the class, later in the semester. And that I had tried rotating it last year and I sort of didn't like it. And after the fact, I remembered why. And the consequence of this is that I'm going to do a rotate on the syllabus, and I will get a new syllabus out, and the apology is for not doing that by the end of last week. So what we're starting now is on the syllabus currently as the week of 6th March. And unfortunately, this means that if you did the reading for this week, it's not wasted because we'll be coming to it next week, but I need to rotate the syllabus. So the reading for 6th March would be a good idea. I created some confusion, probably more than some, by starting the discussion about virtual memory in the way that I did. And in particular, a number of people said, well, they sort of don't understand what it looks like for the program image to get loaded into memory and how it works and how the arrangement happens. So I want to actually go through that today, and I also want to talk about two ideas in greater detail, one being paging, or it's sometimes called swapping, although technically those two things are different, and the other being the notion of copy-on-write and how memory management works. And I should be very explicit that the traditional sequencing of the course and the sequencing you'll find in the textbook is to talk about processes first. I've always found that confusing because it's hard to think about processes without thinking about what it is they're running, and until I have a story about how memory works, I don't know how to deal with that. Unfortunately, the reverse is also true. It's hard to think about, you got the code in memory, now it's running, what does it mean to be running? It's hard to talk about that without talking about processes first. So there's sort of a catch-22. Let me start with, what does a program image look like? And now I'm going to talk in virtual memory, that is, the view of the address space as the application sees it. So the application, and I'm going to restrict myself for this semester to 32-bit machines. Same basic story is true for 64-bit machines. Some details may change, but the basic ideas are similar. On most processors, right, you have a virtual address space that's 32 bits, so the addresses go from 0 to 4 gigabytes. On most processors, it is necessary to reserve a portion of that address space for use by the kernel. And on most of the current operating systems, the portion of the address space that's reserved starts at 3 gigabytes and goes up. Now, this is somewhat architecture specific, but this is the general pattern. The other one you'll occasionally see is reserve taken from the bottom. It's awkward to have it in the middle, so in practice it's either bottom or top, and on almost all architectures, people try to put it at the top. So what the application actually sees is a range of addresses from 0 to 3 gigabytes, because if it makes a reference above 3 gigabytes, it hits the kernel space. That space is marked supervisor only, and so an attempt to reference in that space will generally fail. There's some fine print about this in the system call interface on modern machines, but I'm going to ignore that for the moment. We'll talk about that later. For a variety of reasons, it's convenient if nothing resides at zero. Any of you who have ever encountered a null pointer error already know why this is. You really want it to be the case that if a process goes and doesn't access through address zero, that some fault occurs. You want this for debugging reasons. And one way to achieve that is to say, well, I'll just guarantee you that the page starting at address zero is never valid. Now, this is a software convention. As far as the hardware is concerned, if you were to define a page there, that would be perfectly valid. Right? This is something that we do in software primarily to aid debugging. And realistically, you probably want the first few pages there to be invalid. There's some threshold where you're going to say, eh, it's not worth it anymore. what you want as a practical matter is if somebody has a pointer that they think points to a structure, and that pointer is actually zero, that if they attempt to offset it into this non-existent structure, that with high likelihood you're going to catch it. Realistically, how many structures have you met that were bigger than 4 kilobytes? That's why one page is in practice good enough. So the tradition was, and this story I'm going to change in a second, then there would be some address where the code of the application would start. I'm sorry, it's a little too small. Those of you hiding in the back might consider moving up. It helps me hear you, and it helps you see. So there's a region where the code is, and at least traditionally, immediately above that, there's a second region where data resides. Now, technically, there's no reason for these regions to have to be adjacent. And in fact, on modern machines, there's some reason to keep them separate. But historically, when memory was tight, what would happen is you would look at the program, you'd bind the program together, you'd get some amount of code, and of course, the last page would not be full. And rather than waste a page of memory, which at the time this stuff was engineered was a somewhat precious resource, you would simply start with the data and the end of the code. This saved memory in two places. It saved memory in memory, but also it saved memory in the file system because you also got to share the state of the page in the file system. Now, the problem with this is that there's an overlap page. Right? There's a page that's partially coded and partially data. And this is a problem. Historically, it actually was this way. And if you dig deep into the linker man page for LD, Unix, you'll discover that there are still option flags you can turn on to tell the linker that this is the way things should be linked. And there actually are some good reasons to do this, although fewer and fewer as time goes on. The more common way of linking things is nowadays, where memory is maybe a little less critical, is to say, we're going to share this page for purposes of layout in the binary file, and I'll come back to what's in the binary file. Kind of telling the story in the circular fashion. What we'll do is we will separate the code and data regions cleanly. Okay? So we'll have a clean dividing line now between the code and the data. And we're going to arrange things so that in memory there's a last page of the code and there's a first page of the data. These are actually the same page. Let me come back and hold that thought. But basically, data is not going to start at a page address. Why? Because code probably would not conveniently end at a page address. And I will walk you through how this stuff gets loaded, and hopefully this stuff will become a little more clear. So let me flip to what's going on in the file format. But before I do that, you also have the stack region. Okay. Just to finish out the story, on modern machines, the stack, you have a big hole in the middle, okay, that I have obviously not drawn to scale. The stack basically grows downwards. And now, what about the memory that you allocate with malloc? Well, that memory, by tradition, starts at the end of the data region, grows upwards. And by strong convention, which was, I believe, started in Unix, but got so deeply embedded in the C programming language that it de facto became part of the standard for everything, the address of the beginning of code has a label associated with it called text. Traditionally, when these things were jumbled together, there was a label called data. Nowadays, they're not jumbled together, and there's another label called etext or end of text. And now, if you think about what goes into a C program, you may have globals that are initialized, and you have other globals that are not initialized. For historical reasons, these two things, and good historical reasons, they're still valid, these two things are not commingled in the binary image. So if you look at the binary image first, there's no stack in the binary image, right? We're not running that. The a.out file, the exe file, if you're a Windows lover, doesn't have a stack. So if you look at the binary file, what you'll discover is that the layout of the binary file basically is, hey, there's a header that tells us where things are in the file. There's code. This is the thing that's going to become what's known as the text region. It's often referred to in the file as the text section. And there's the data region. Now, about that uninitialized data. The specification requires, the specification of scene requires, that if there's uninitialized data, that at the time it is loaded into memory, it will be filled with zeros. So, logically, this is not actually present in the file. Logically, there's a region in the file that's called BSS, which is the uninitialized data. However, this section does not actually appear in the file. It doesn't appear in the file because we don't need to store it because we already know what's in it, zeros. Why? Because that's how the definition of BSS. BSS, by the way, I always forget what it stands for, but it earned its name from an instruction from one of the early IBM machines, block store or something. I forget exactly. The upshot of it is there's an instruction that's really good if you want to write a long sequence of zeros. And BSS turns out to be the name of that instruction. So that's how it got to be called the BSS section. Now, oh boy, you know what? I'm going to start this middle of this diagram over. Just because, no, I'm not changing what's in it. I just realized I've drawn it terribly. All right. So in this file, one of the things that we'd like to do, we'd really like to arrange things so that they're at page offsets in this file. And the reason why will not become clear until we talk more about the file systems, which we'll get to later in this semester. So there are two tricks that are very commonly used, in fact, almost universally used in modern binary images. The first is that, so technically, that address, wherever it gets loaded in memory, that piece of the file, that offset of the file, right? That's the offset that's going to end up being the start of the text. But obviously, that offset is not likely to be a page boundary. If we want it to be the page boundary, we've got two options, and both of them historically have been dropped. The first is to say, after the header, we'll leave a gap in the file up to the start of the text section. So that the text section, first option is don't do anything, right? We'll build up the file as though text were at a page start address, and when we load the file, we'll simply put it at a page start address. Now, the problem with this is it requires copies, and the copies are expensive, and it makes some other things we want to do difficult, so it's convenient if we can somehow arrange for code to start at a page number. Likewise for data. All right, option two. Pad the header up to the next page boundary. Fill it with zeros. I don't care what it's full of. We're not going to look at it anyway. It's garbage bytes. And that was one common design option. That turns out to be surprisingly wasteful. If you go and look at binary sizes on Unix prior to the last 5 years, you discover that most of the binaries in Unix are actually quite small. There's been a certain amount of code bloat in recent years. Actually, there's been progressive code bloat for the last 40 years, but it seems to have hit an asymptotic increase. Turned to be in a curve somewhere. All right, so the third option, suppose we cheat. Suppose we say, well, what we're going to do, we know the size of the header. So what we're going to do, we're just going to include it in the code section. Okay, so when this file gets loaded into memory, we're actually going to load starting at the start of the file, not starting at the start of the code section. So we will have some unused bytes at the beginning of the code section when we load it into memory. Now, the advantage of this is, actually, the header is pretty small, so it's not very many unused bytes. And the important thing we wanted was to guarantee that the thing that we were going to load started at a page boundary. So simply by sort of building a space for the header into the start of the code region, we get that. Well, we also would like the start of data to be at a page boundary. That one's a little messy. And again, there are three options. Move the data all the way through. We've already talked about that for the same reasons as the code. We want to avoid it. Pad the text section. And that was done for a while. Or, here's option three. There's some range in the file that's a page in size, assuming the file is large enough. And that page in the file contains some code and it also contains some data. So here's one thing we could do. And notice these two pieces of stuff that I need to load into memory, right? They overlap, or at least they would if I could, yeah. They overlap that page. So one thing that we could do is say, well, when we build up the memory image of the process, and now I'm only going to consider up to 3 gig because we're not really interested in the operating system at the moment. What we'll do, we'll build the text region in the address space, and we will build that essentially by taking the text chunk of the file, including the header. That will become the text region in memory. And someplace else, for reasons of tradition, someplace that's closely related to the end of the text region, we don't want to go very far from there, probably at the next page address up. We'll put the data region of the file. Now we've got to deal with BSS. BSS is a little easier because the data, this BSS section isn't really here. So yes, we could have an overlapping page at the end, but it turns out it doesn't matter. The reason it doesn't matter is this BSS section isn't really here. The file actually ends conceptually at the end of the data section. So what's going to happen if we look at the structure of the page is we're going to get a little extra region at the very end of the data area. We're going to have to zero fill that region by hand. And then what we'll do is we'll put BSS above here. Actually, we're going to count this region as part of BSS because we know it's already zero, so that's okay. So this BSS box, you should understand, it's a bus data. It's right at the end of it. The last thing that's in the binary image, in some cases, not all, is we may learn from the binary image where the stack should be. But in the absence of being told, by convention, we'll put the stack at the top of user addressable memory. Why at the top we want it as far away from the heap as we can get it, because the two of them are trying to grow into each other. And now what's going to happen is the heap is going to grow up. Starting at the top of BSS, it's going to grow upwards. So in the traditional picture, all of the data is contiguous, right? Think of the stuff that gets preloaded from the binary as initialization of stuff that's towards the bottom of the heap. And then everything else is dynamically allocated. All right, why do we want to separate this stuff? Why do we want it at page boundaries? Well, the first reason is, it would be really good if you can't write on top of code. You cannot overwrite code. There are certainly some programming languages for which we want you to overwrite code. That's a relatively, I was about to say that's a relatively recent development, which isn't true. But aside from a few somewhat unusual research languages, that hasn't been a popular idea. It was so unpopular that when the RS-6000 designers were designing the RS-6000, they simply rejected out of hand anything that did self-modifying code. And I can't begin to tell you how ignorant a position that was on Andy Heller's part. But certainly if we're talking about a traditional binary language, where we're not using something like Java where we do just-in-time compilation, that's something where we don't want to do this. We would like to say that the text region is read-only. At the very least, if it's not supposed to be modified, we would like a chance to catch the application if it makes a mistake. On the other hand, let's see, if I write it down there, I'm not sure. We would like to say that the data region in the heap and the stack region are read-write. Because if they're not read-write, you're not going to be able to store there, and that's obviously something we want to be able to do. And on more recent processors and on really old processors, but not on Pentium processors, until recently, we'd also like to say, probably, that the data region and the stack region are not executable. This is a security issue. It turns out it's a dubious security issue. If you don't permit execute out of these regions, it turns out it's fairly easy to work around that for an attacker. Also, it turns out there is a short list, very short list, of performance critical algorithms that really do want to generate code at runtime, even in C. The historical example of this would have been bitlib, although on modern processors, the motivation for that has become much reduced. But there are a bunch of other graphics algorithms and things of that sort where, in fact, it's very common for those specialized algorithms to proceed by generating code to the stack and then executing out of the stack. Okay, was there a question there? Okay. So, how does all this relate to page tables? Well, I've said, let me see, how do I want to do this? Okay, I want to throw one more piece into this picture, and then I'm going to take away the picture of the file. Hold on. Okay. When we're talking about things in the file, the terminology that's used is sections. Nowadays, you will also find in ELF binary images term regions used, and that's going to cause us tremendous confusion until I come back to this. So for the moment, I'm not going to use that term for file. When we talk about them in the address space, after being loaded, we generally use the term regions. Well, let me write it down here. So we'll talk about the text region of the address space. And in case somebody's tempted to ask me, this story does not yet consider what happens when you put dynamic libraries into the picture, and that's deliberate. Let's do this in a little bit. Okay. So when people talk about sections, they're talking about something in a binary file. When people talk about regions, they're talking about something in a memory image. With that said, I now want to erase the picture of the file, and I want to show you what the mapping structures look like for this. Or at least what they would look like if we had actually used all of these parts of the address space. And I'm going to go ahead and use the Pentium mapping structures, although I have more to say about mapping structures coming probably tomorrow. But if we start with the Pentium structures, then up at the top, you have a page directory. And we have a collection of page tables and logically, we have enough page tables so that every entry in the page directory points to a page table, but most of those page tables, again, the drawing is not the scale, most of those page tables point to regions in here. Those regions are completely undefined, and so there's no real reason to have a page table that just says, oh, my page is undefined, 1,000 times over, right? That would be silly. So in that case, what we do is we use the valid bit in the page directory. Remember what the entry looks like. We use the valid bit in the page directory to say, nothing below here is valid, don't even bother. So if you have a fully invalid page table, you can remove it and just say, in the entry in the page directory, everything below here is not valid. So as a practical matter, what we're going to end up with in the vast majority of programs, we're going to end up with one page table up towards the top of memory, and the entries in this page table are going to describe pages in the stack. And in spite of what you might think, the entry in the page directory is not at the top of the page directory. It's about three quarters up. The reason it's three quarters up is because this very high region of the address space is reserved by the kernel. And so the uppermost entries in the page directory are actually going to be occupied by kernel entries. But the entry corresponding to just below the 3 gigabyte boundary, we're going to have a page table there. Assume the stack ended up just below 3 gigabytes. The stack grows downwards. And for that reason, as the stack grows downwards, how does the stack grow? Well, let me do that next. But as the stack grows downwards, we're going to end up adding page table entries to describe more and more pages of the stack. I'll explain that process in a moment. Typically, stacks are not very big. It's unusual to have a process with more than two or three stack pages. Often, they may have as few as one. That's just a pragmatic observation. There's no necessary reason why that should be true. In practice, the reason that a program might have lots and lots and lots of stack pages is somebody did an unbounded recursion. It almost always means there's a program error. Now, down at the start of the world, sort of down, probably not at zero because we want to reserve that page, but down starting at the start of text, we're going to have another page table, okay? And this one is going to have entries that map the text region. How many? I don't know. How much code do you have? That's how many. We're going to divide the code into pages. We're going to have one entry for each page. Heck, we might even run off the end of this page table into another one. We'll just keep going until we've got enough. And at some point, we'll say, oh, we're done with code, and then we'll have a gap. How big depends on what generation system you're looking at, and then we'll start from the entries to the data region. And those entries will continue up to the end of the heap. And as the heap grows, we'll add more of those entries. So what actually happens... I'm jumping ahead of myself. So this is how the mapping structure gets used. Why do we have all these entries? Mainly because under the covers, the text region and the data region and the BSS region and the stack region, in the eyes of the operating system, in the eyes of the kernel, these regions are divided into pages. These pages are scattered all throughout your system memory. And I'm ignoring large pages on purpose, and I will ignore large pages for the rest of the semester, for those of you who know what they are. It turns out there are reasons not to scatter things, but most operating systems do. Why? Well, because, you know, at the time we went to load this image, who the heck knows what frames of the memory were available? We want to just grab the frames that are available, we'll get things loaded somehow, and we'll use the remapping structure to let us find them later. So that's what's going on here. So, now, in this page directory, what's likely happening is these page tables that describe code and data, the entries for those in the page directory are probably contiguous. Why? Because the code and the data, the text and the data were contiguous. Then there's a huge gap, and then we get up to the one for the stack, and then above that we'll have some page tables for the kernel, but I'm not going to talk about those just yet. Now, this first page table, why is this not in the first slot of the page directory? Because on modern systems, it turns out the code doesn't start as close to the bottom as I've drawn it. It starts considerably higher up. And below that is where we're going to put dynamic libraries when we get around to talking about dynamic libraries. Okay, questions about what's going on here? I still have to explain how these entries get built. But the conceptual idea is we're going to start with that file. When you go to run that program, we're going to pick up the file, we're going to take the sections of the file, we're going to create the corresponding regions in memory, and at least conceptually, we're going to copy the file into those regions in memory, and then we're going to execute. I'm being very careful to say conceptually, because this is not what really happens, but it's a good start. So we're going to copy the file into memory, we're going to branch to someplace to start the application. And since I'm doing symbol names, by strong convention, the address of the first instruction that we will execute is called underscore start. You may have thought that C programs started execution in main. They do not. There's lots of stuff that runs before main. Actually, in good designs, there's not so much stuff that runs before main, ignoring C++ where we have to get constructors. No, on second thought, I'll stick to my first statement. In good designs, there's not so much stuff that runs before main. I feel entitled to say that since parts of C++ are my fault. It's somewhat more rude to poop on other people's work, although that doesn't usually stop. And I'll explain one of the hazards in C++ later when we get to dynamic libraries. One of the many. All right. So, conceptually, we're doing this copy. Any questions about this?
Just step back for a second. There is, since this is the view of the memory world for one program, does that mean that each application or program running has its own page directory and page table?
Almost. So here's a couple of statements I can make, but I'm going to have to qualify some. So, yes, in practice, it's the case that, I don't want to say this. Okay, we're getting into the processes conundrum. I need to talk to processes before I can fully answer your question. So here's what I can say safely. If we ignore multi-thread, which we're going to have to talk about later, but until we get to multi-threading, as long as we say each program has one thread of execution, it is the case that each program has its own page directory. More precise statement would be to say each address space has one page directory, and a single application resides and executes out of a single address space. But if that application has more than one thread of execution, they may all point to the same page directory. In fact, that's what it means to have more than one thread of execution, is that they share an address space. How do you share an address space? By sharing the page directory at the implementation level. Now, the other question you asked was about page tables, and here I have to be a little bit cagey. Again, ignoring multi-thread, it's the case that any page table entry that points to modified not modifiable, modified data. The page table entry is private, and in order for the page table entry to be private, the page table will be private. So to first order, you can assume that all those page tables that pointing to data DSS and stack, either they are private or they're going to be soon. And that will become a little bit clearer when I explain how the loading mechanism really works. Page tables that point to the code are not, in fact, private to the address space, but you'll never catch us failing to preserve the illusion that they are private, and that's going to be most of the subject of Wednesday. So for the moment, I would say, assume that all the mapping structures are in fact separate. Each address space has its own copy of these overhead structures. But let me also say that's an undesirable state because these overhead structures are overhead structures, and we're going to look for ways to optimize that. And the main way that we're going to optimize that is by taking advantage of places where we won't get caught by sharing. They are logically separate. That's probably more detail than you want. Side question there.
When you say an address space is private, how is that marked as native?
It's not. It's a fact. All address spaces are private.
So you say that every program has its own page directory, and therefore, just because it doesn't have access to the other page directory?
I'm hedging. I'm saying every address space has its own page directory, and the reason I'm hedging is I haven't stated what the relationship is yet between programs, address spaces, and processes, and I can't do that cleanly until we get to talking about processes. The question hiding under the question that you're asking me is, what does it mean to be a program? And that's not an idle question, but it's a question we can't answer until we talk about processes. So what I want to talk about right now is the address space, and I'm going to wave my hands, I'm going to ignore multi-threading this week, and as long as they have one thread, then I can answer your question. And the answer to your question is, well, at this level, there are no applications, right? There are running images. Right? So the thing you think of as the application, that's the binary file. When the binary file gets started running, when we load it into memory, there's now a running image. That running image occupies an address space. More precisely, the address space is a mapping of that running image, and I need to get to that. And as long as you're talking about one thread of control, then every time you start a copy of that application, we're going to create a new address space. That address space is going to have a process associated with it, and that process will execute instructions from this address space. But that's not the only possible relationship. So for the moment, just as a placeholder picture, right, the story is we have some process, okay, and this process is executing instructions from an address space, and this address space is, in a way that I'm about to describe, constructed from, or loaded from, or composed by extracting from an executable image. And I apologize that I have to be juggling three balls until two of them stick in the air and stay put. And we'll get to those balls later. And the two balls that I'm telling you to stay put are, what the heck is a process? And I also haven't told you this executable image, where it's stored. And we all sort of know the answer is, well, there's this thing called a file system, but we're going to have to talk about how that works to fill in all of the dots on the story for this week. And we're not going to get to that just yet. Does that give you a sufficient answer for right now? And just as a hint, if we do get around to talking about multiple threads, what's going to happen is, and this now depends on the OS, either we're going to break up this process abstraction into threads, or we're going to say there's more than one process and they reference the same address space. And I'll get to that. One of the problems with the process as threads issue is there is no general agreement on what thread means. It makes it difficult to teach about. Okay. observation. In any given execution, you will not run most of the code in your binary. Indeed, about 30% of the code in your binary exists for the purpose of recovering from circumstances you hope like hell as a developer never happen. You may have noticed that in the absence of exceptions, you will tend to write code of the form do something. If that fails, then print the following diagnostic and call exit. If you're really good, you may have written code that says, if that fails, do this, and then go to that other piece of code which will try vainly to recover. Vainly in practice. Now, of course, the consequence of this is that only one line in three of your program is actually meaningful. Right? The other two lines in that pattern exist because of something you fervently hope does not happen. And in fact, people don't write those lines of code. They're too lazy. And the reason their programs mostly work anyway is that the expectation that these things that shouldn't happen won't happen is in fact fulfilled most of the time. It is rare for users to do things, well, for programs to do things that misbehave. When they do, it's almost always because the user handed them bad input. So the shortcut that a lot of programmers take is you only validate things that have to do with bad input and you assume that everything else will work right. More precisely, you assume that if the other stuff does not work right, there's no way to recover anyway, which is mostly true. After 5 or 10 years of experience programming in the wild, you will change your attitude about this and you will start checking error codes. Unfortunately, the vast majority of code in the world is written by people during the first 5 years of their career, which explains partly why all of this crap. As in so many things, there's no substitute for experience. Okay. So most of that code is not going to get executed. And just to give a concrete example, in C++, if you actually look at what goes into a binary image that's been sort of directly designed, you'll discover that about a third of the code, a third of the binary that comes out of the compiler, it's exception handling code. Exceptions definitely fall into this category of things you fervently hope do not happen. That's why they're called exceptions. They refer to exceptional circumstances. A third of that code is therefore never going to get run. And in fact, the smart leakers that deal sensibly with C++ code are careful to move that code so that it's all adjacent, either at the start or at the end of the text region. Why? Well, because then we will never visit that one third of the text region, and that means we don't even have to load it into memory. Which brings me to the punchline for today, and I'm going to take questions about this. So, there are two competing design rules in operating systems. Right. The first is, if something is going to fail, you'd like it to fail quicker. Sooner is better. Because once you know something's going to fail, it's going to exit. It's going to get out of your way, and it's going to free up resources. So the minute you know something's going to fail, help it! This is one of the few domains where assisted suicide is a feature. The other is, don't do any work you don't have to do unless you've got a really good reason to do it. And here we have two subcases. One is, if I don't know you're going to need something, I shouldn't get it for you. And the second is, well, but we need to cheat on that rule because there's some cases where I do know that you're highly likely to need something. And so, in the interest of performance, if I have extra resource, I should get it ahead of time. For example, I know that the order of reference to pages in the data region with high likelihood is sequential. That's an empirical observation. If you touch one page, you touch the next page, you touch the third page, you know what? You're going to touch the fourth page. And if I have an opportunity to get it for you ahead of time, I should do it. If I have the opportunity and I have the available resources. But now we're getting into optimization. So the way to think about optimizations is first, start with the principle that you should do nothing until you know it's necessary, because you don't want to tie down resources you don't need. Now with that as your starting position, Then what we'll do is we will whittle away at that position, optimizing things later. But the optimizations, we should be explicit, we're violating some policies, we're violating some properties of design in order to get better performance. And the reason to approach it in this way, to first understand what the properties are and then understand where to violate them, is at least now we know what the specification of the system behavior is, and we can ask them to be optimized correctly. So we'll start with the first, which is don't do any work you don't have. Now, in my story about how a program image gets loaded, I did a lot of work I didn't have to. Namely, I loaded all this crap into memory that you're mostly not going to touch. And I allocated all this storage to hold these page tables and this page directory, much of which you're not going to need because you're not going to touch the parts of the image that the storage points to. And until you actually touch it, I don't need these data structures at all. So I'm about to do a nasty piece of sleight of hand, and before I do you see what's happening in this table structure? Because I'm about to make it complicated. So let's make sure we have this before I move on. I saw a question inching up there. Everybody think they understand what's going on here? Okay. So what does it mean, don't do things until you have to? Another way to do this is to say, do the work lazily. Hope sometimes we'll try to do it in advance, but just in time. Like that's the optimization. But the principle is we're going to do it lazily. All right, so what really happens here? And I am going to repeat this starting tomorrow morning. One, operating system does not load code, data, or stack. Two, operating system does not construct page tables or page directories at the time you start the program. All of these things are going to happen, but they're not going to happen eagerly. What does have to happen eagerly? Operating system must make bookkeeping records to say, I am forming a new address space. And this address space, at least for the duration that it lives, has to have a unique identifier. We have to have a way to reference it. At least internally, we need a name for it. So I've called it 1076, but there's no significance to this number. It's just a number. Different from any other number of any other current address space. Now what we're going to say is, what's in this address space? And this address space is going to be defined by something called a region list. Region list is going to operate as follows. It's going to have a sequence of entries. These entries start with a base and a bound. So every region in the address space has a bottom address and a top address. That's the base and the bound. What this region list means, what each entry means, first, also, the entries in the region list are non-overlapping. No address will be covered by more than one entry in the region list. The next thing we're going to have something called a backing file and an offset. And a set of permissions. The permissions say things like, this region is read-only, this region is read-write. And And I'm going to have to come back and revisit that in file, so take that with quotes. What does this mean? Sorry, let me be clear. This is a file offset. All right. What this says is, suppose the application makes a reference to some address A, and we don't already have A in the address space. We don't know where that page is. We haven't loaded it. Step one is we go screaming down the region list looking for something where the base and bound A falls within them. If we don't find it, this address is invalid. And we're going to tell the application so. If we do find it, the next problem is, oh, okay, now we know we have a valid address, and we better go get the content corresponding to that address. Well, not quite. First, before we get the content, we better allocate a page table that's going to cover this region. Because when we do get the content, we're going to need to build a page table entry. We can't do that until we have a page table. Well, not quite. In order to build an entry that names the page table, we're going to need a page directory entry. We can't fill in that entry until we have a page directory. So if the process does not already have one, the very first thing we're going to do is grab a page directory by allocating a frame out of memory. Then we're going to allocate a page table. Initially, both of these, the page directory entry will point to the page table entry will say not valid. Because we haven't got the page yet. Now we've got to get the page, and I know I'm out of time, so let me run through this and I will start it again in the morning. To get the page, we have an address that's somewhere between base and bound. We're going to subtract base from the address. This gives us a region relative offset. And it therefore gives us a section relative offset in the file. Because the region is the thing that resulted from loading the section, logically. We're actually doing the load right now. So we have an offset relative to region, and that offset is therefore an offset relative to section. The thing that we need now is we need to know where in the file did the section begin. We're going to add that. That's the file offset. Now we know the byte offset in the file that is the content that should appear at this address, at least initially. And from that, we're going to work out what is the surrounding page. That's probably what we did. We truncated the address down to a page boundary before we started this, because at the OS level, we're interested in finding pages, not bytes. And we're going to go to the page, and we're going to load a file, we're going to go to the file, and we're going to load a page worth of stuff. We're going to find a frame, memory. We're going to put that page in the file in that frame. Then we're going to go back to the page table entry that we built, and we're going to mark it valid. And we're going to let the process resume execution, and it will reattempt the load or store instruction, and this time all of the necessary stuff is in memory, and so that load or store will succeed. This whole process is being done lazily. Let me go through it again. So the story I said about how we're going to load stuff in memory early is completely wrong. It's a logically accurate story. But we're going to do it one page at a time in response to demand. So, please come tomorrow morning with questions about this, because I know this was tricky and it was done quickly, and I want to do it right.